Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spartan Life Radio, brought to you by Norfolk State University, home of the mighty Spartans. Spartan Life Radio was created with you in mind. It's your source for news and information about NSU matters, including students, faculty, staff, administrators, alumni, and the communities we serve.
The largest cybersecurity breach in U.S. history took place just last month when hackers gained access to personnel records in the Office of Personnel Management, or OPM. The FBI this week reports that more than 18 million current, former, and prospective federal workers' personal information was impacted by a cyber breach, almost triple the number that was first released. Sony Entertainment was hacked last year as it was set to release The Interview, a controversial film about North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Blue Cross Blue Shield in the D.C. area recently notified more than a million of its customers that their private information had been compromised. Target literally became a marked objective as hackers took aim at thousands of customers by compromising their credit card information last year. So how safe is your private information, your bank account, your tax returns, or your health information? We're talking about cybersecurity today on this episode of Spartan Life Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Michael Cotter, your host. You got a question about today's topic? Call us at 1-347-850-8515. That number again, 1-347-850-8515. Press 1 on your telephone keypad if you want to speak to our guest. Reports of attacks on computer network systems have dominated the news most recently, and more, we're hearing about attacks and hackers who are maliciously cracking network codes and taking down firewalls. And naturally, you're wondering, what can I do to protect my business, my private information, and my finances? Well, on this episode of Spartan Life Radio, we have two cybernet security experts from Norfolk State University's Science, Engineering, and Technology Department. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, again, at 1-347-850-8515. Today, our guests are Dr. Aurelia Williams, Associate Professor and Chair of Computer Science Department, and she's here at Norfolk State University, so we're proud to have her. Her most recent accomplishment is the award of $25 million from the Department of Energy for NSU to lead a consortium of 13 schools, DOE laboratories, and a public school district to increase the workforce pipeline in cybersecurity. Dr. Williams received her bachelor's and master's degrees in computer science from NSU and Johns Hopkins University, respectively. She received a doctoral degree from Pace University with an emphasis in computer science education. Also joining us today on Spartan Life Radio is Dr. Claude Turner, associate professor with NSU's Computer Science Department. Now, Dr. Turner's research interests include cybersecurity, digital forensics, data analytics, signal processing, and cybersecurity education. His teaching experience spans nearly 20 years, primarily in the area of computer science. Dr. Turner is the former director of the Center for Cybersecurity and Engineering Technologies at Bowie State University. I want to welcome you both to Spartan Life Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are excited to have the opportunity to join in.
Okay, and Dr. Williams, I understand that you have an additional guest with you today. Can you introduce that person for me?
Yes, we also have Dr. Jonathan Graham, professor of computer science, and he is also our director of the Information Assurance Research, Education, and Development Institute here at Norfolk State University.
Right.
He has an extensive background in cybersecurity education, research, and outreach.
Well, that's good, because you know what? We're going to need a lot of hands to weigh in on this one, and we need all the voices we can get to help us walk through this cybersecurity maze, and certainly it is that when we break it down. So let's get started. Everywhere you look, there are growing incidents of breaches in security, whether we're talking about the federal government, which is surprising given the unprecedented proliferation of Homeland Security following 9/11, or whether we're talking about Joe Citizen having his personal information compromised because he used his credit or debit card to purchase a pair of pajamas, let's say, from a clothing store. So naturally, one has to ask, Dr. Williams, why are so many of these cybersecurity incidents taking place?
Well, the more sophisticated attacks are carried out by professionals or paid agents, for example. However, there is a vast majority of just curious people who want to see if they can make an episode happen. So to answer the question, we don't necessarily know, but some countries have interest in breaking U.S. systems, and others are just inquisitive people, just seeing if they can do it.
Okay, and Dr. Turner?
One of the reasons is that there are a lot of tools that are freely available that can be used to do malicious attacks. And a person doesn't have to be a professional to use these tools. They can be easily downloaded. These are what we call as script kiddies. They can download these software and actually use them to launch attacks on other machines. And I believe there are some additional reasons, and Dr. Graham can speak to some of those.
Hello?
Yeah.
Right. There are more targets on the Internet these days. As you probably noticed, like maybe yourself, Michael, a few years ago, you'll be doing all your banking by going into the bank. Now you're doing it online. Shopping online is something new. So we have a lot more people using the Internet than we had a few years ago. Most of these people are not trained. And also, there's a lot more data. Like, there's been a push to have everything electronic available on the Internet, like, you know, health records, banking information, a lot more things are online now than a few years ago. So there are much richer targets now than a few years ago.
Well, you know, that's interesting because you have even new directives now that are issued by banks to not only cover, you know, the keypad when PIN numbers are being entered, but people are being instructed to retouch the keys when they finish their transactions because of fingertip heat transfer to the keys that can be easily read by a savvy thief. So I'm not sure if everyone is aware of this growing threat, but can you help our listeners understand what's going on here?
Yeah. Well, there's software called key loggers. They could be in hardware too. So when a person types, it basically checks what the person is typing. So that's someone for someone to steal your password. They're able to see what you're typing on your keyboard when you hit every stroke. You know, these kind of software are also freely available that people can download and use.
So there's that much of a thermal transfer to a keypad when I'm going to an ATM that someone can actually come behind me and figure out what keys I just punched?
On an ATM machine. Well, with that, I guess someone would have to be able to see it with some kind of camera or something. I'm not sure. Maybe one of my colleagues might have something else to add to that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think the average person can actually capture that information. That seems to be information that maybe someone like in the government, seeing the very sophisticated instruments would be needed to capture that thermal transfer on the keypad.
I would have to think that it would almost have to be immediate. As soon as I'm done, for instance, 5-10 minutes go by before someone else comes to the ATM, that information, even if someone were to come and try to capture it, that the pressing of those keys would be pretty cold by that point. Would you agree or no?
Well, you know, like those infrared cameras, they can, from a distance, they can sense the heat. So that's what I'm thinking. It was more like someone who has very sophisticated equipment.
Okay.
Who maybe who can actually capture the keys and see the heat transfer.
Right. I mean, if the machine itself is compromised, I mean, because, I mean, an ATM is an embedded system. It's a machine. So people can hack into machines, especially if they're connected to the Internet, and install malicious software on those machines. So that's another possible way.
Is any business, any person, any software or firewall immune to a cyber invasion? In short, is anyone safe?
We would say that they are acceptable levels of risk that all companies assume. With that being said, you know, no one can say that someone is 100% safe because new attacks are developed every day. And often, by the time the press or the community hears about the attacks have happened, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 months previous to that. But it's just been kept under wraps until there's more information that, you know, the companies have learned about it, how to defend against the attacks before inviting other people with, you know, information that could possibly use against them.
Now, hacking into a healthcare organization's network has to generate a kind of helplessness and sense of personal violation, unlike anything Americans have ever experienced. It's almost beyond insane to contemplate whether or not I should seek medical care because I run the risk of having my personal information hacked and used for some illicit purpose. So let's see if we can bring some clarity to the issue here. In a worst-case scenario, what kind of damage could a cyber thief do with a patient's personal information? And if I could, I'd like to get all three of you to weigh in on this one.
There's quite a bit of damage. First of all, if you can access every information for the patient, medicine, the dosage, the treatment, like allergy information is there, and that can be changed, the patient's life is at risk. Someone may change the diagnosis, they may increase the dosage, they may make change to that medical information. And even if that information is not there, the embarrassment of having your medical information maybe placed online, that could be embarrassing. Or if your employers know about your medical conditions, that may affect employment, although it is not supposed to. So, but the main problem would be, in my opinion, the risk to the patient's health and life by having someone with the capability of changing the medical dosage or treatment plans for that patient.
Okay.
So I intend to agree with Dr. Graham. I think additionally there could be a lot of embarrassment. Someone could make your medical records available on social media like Facebook and other things like that. And now it's open on the public internet. But I believe the biggest problem would be if the person goes and modifies the patient's record and, you know, put incorrect medication or incorrect diagnosis. Those kind of issues are probably even more immediate for the person and more detrimental.
Okay, and we're certainly seeing that with Blue Cross and Blue Shield, like I mentioned earlier at the top of the show in D.C. area, you know, where so many people had their information compromised. And so naturally people are concerned and they want to know the best way to protect themselves. But again, it's one of those enduring questions that I think we'll be discussing in not only months to come but in years to come if we don't find a way to plug some of the leaks that we have in security. But next, I have a two-part question. And first, I would like to know, how much do cybercrimes cost the American public on average? And then the second question, I'll repeat it if I need to, why is it taking corporations a long time to plug those gaps and find innovative ways to protect consumers and sensitive data? Dr. Williams?
So a 2013 joint study by the Center of Strategic and International Studies estimate that the cost of cybercrime and cyber espionage is about $100 billion a year. And you would have to assume that the cyber crime when persons' information is compromised, it leaks into many areas. So, for example, like in the healthcare, the changing of the medicine would be one way that it could, you know, hurt the public. But also in your medical information, you have a lot of other things, maybe credit cards that you use, your house, where you live. If people can take all of those pieces and acquire enough information about you, then they can create your identity, run up credit cards in your name. And then those companies who have to figure out if these were legitimate expenses then have to go back and refund you. So the cost of cybercrime leaks to so many areas that it, because it's so widespread.
Okay. Yeah. And the second part of the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to add that, you know, businesses are in the business of making money. And having more security measures in place is not always cost effective for a business. So, I mean, the main job of a business is to make money, not to be secure. I mean, if security becomes a problem that they are forced to deal with, like they cause them to lose money or cause certain legal ramifications, then businesses pay attention. But typically, businesses, they're there to make money, not necessarily to be secure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not, the government has been forcing them to pay more attention to security. But say, for example, if you have a computer application that's really secure and running very slowly, customers may not put up with it. They may rather something quick and fast that they can get on and off the Internet, get their business done, as opposed to something slow and secure. So until businesses have real financial disasters from security, it may not be the most pressing priority for them.
Well, I think that might even answer the second part of the question, why it's taking corporations such a long time to plug the gaps, because I was looking at, excuse me, a report by the General Accounting Office, and they're saying exactly what you're saying as it relates to Sony, and they were talking about the reality that the numbers that seem very large to the average person is really negligible to a lot of companies, because it probably takes them more money to plug up those holes than it would take them simply to compensate people who might have found their information breached. In fact, on the same report, I saw it said that Target's loss of $40 million of debit and credit card numbers and 70 million other records, which included addresses and phone numbers, was in fact considered negligible, because the company recently said the total bill was $252 million between 2013 and 2014, and after $90 million in dollars in insurance coverage, $162 million was left, and that tax deductions brought that amount down to $105. So it's about 0.1% of Target's 2014 revenue. Basically, it's easier for them to ignore the problem, that's what I'm hearing you're saying, than it is to not just necessarily ignore the problem, but not to fix it financially, and simply to let those breaches occur, and the insurance basically take care of those breaches when they do occur. Is that pretty much the picture?
Yeah, I mean, I said businesses tend to look at the bottom line, and it's not always cost-effective to have all these security measures in place. As a matter of fact, several years ago, businesses were not required to report these break-ins. So they never did. The customers never knew. It never really cost the business anything. Businesses, not just in cybersecurity, in all aspects, businesses have to be forced to do certain things, you know, that affect their bottom line, you know. So they're not going to go ahead and spend money that they don't have to.
Sure. Dr. Turner, excuse me, like a lot of people, I bank online, I shop online, I love using social media to connect. What are some practical things I can do, some practical things people in general can do to protect personal information and finances?
Well, one of the things you want to do, you want to use strong passwords, both for your bank account that you when you log in online, and for your own computer itself. And you don't want to use public networks, like you would go to Starbucks or even the public library. You don't want to be doing transactions from those places. So strong passwords are usually as long as possible, maybe 20 characters or more, and include a mixture of numbers, letters, special characters. And they shouldn't be like dictionary words like your name or your mom's name or your children's name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want it to be have a sense of randomness. You need to have a good virus software on your computer, and so you can know when they are malicious software on your computer. You have to be careful when you read emails. Sometimes you could get emails from fake websites that are claiming to be your bank, and you know some people just inadvertently click on these links, and when you go to those sites, you know they're able to, and you start typing like if you're going to log into your bank, you, you know they can get your password and user information, and they can actually log into your account if they want to, and use it for other reasons.
Sure.
So those are a few of the things. I'm not sure if my colleagues would like to add more to that.
Yeah, I would say like avoid clicking on things that you don't really know about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you notice that on Facebook, for example, there is always a link to some fantastic story, and usually those links tend to be virus traps and so on. So avoid clicking on links just because.
Right. Well, it's sometimes difficult for the unwary to know what constitutes a legitimate link and what might be compromised and how their security might be compromised if they click on it. Everyone likes information. Going to the Internet is an easy place to get that information. You see things embedded in Facebook. Someone might even send something via Twitter. And certainly people are a little curious about those things when they see them. So the natural inclination is to click. And that's pretty much the kind of world we live in, to get the information. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion or if you have a question, please call us at area code 347-850-8515. Press 1 on your telephone keypad if you want to talk to our guests. Or you can listen live at blogtalkradio.com/SpartanLife or via your telephone or other mobile device. We're going to shift gears here a little bit. And in light of the escalating cybersecurity risk, and we certainly don't see this problem going away anytime soon, Norfolk State University has been rather proactive in meeting those challenges by increasing the pool of well-educated security professionals. I'm really happy to see that we're taking the lead on this thing. Can you all talk about Norfolk State University's cybersecurity degree program, the grant funding, and pipeline for cybersecurity workforce?
So Norfolk State University was fortunate enough to secure, as the lead, $25 million effort to produce cybersecurity professionals. We are in partnership with 11 other schools. Most of them are in South Carolina, and then Charleston County School District, and then Lawrence Livermore National Labs, Sandia National Labs, and Spavor. And in this effort, we are bridging opportunities through research, through coursework, through just lots of opportunities to give students from elementary age through college an introduction to cybersecurity. We know that research says if you provide the opportunities early, keep the students engaged, then they will persist in majors like computer science, which cybersecurity is a tangent. So we are very excited to have that opportunity. And in addition to that, we have secured another $5 million or $4.8 million, which is a collaborative effort that is going to conduct basic research and developing a cloud-based big data analytics-capable cyber analysis, simulation, and experimentation environment. And that environment will help us to enhance situational awareness and decision support capabilities for cyber training. So it'll give us more of a live environment in which our students can actually participate.
So what is NSU actually doing in particular to train the new crop of cybersecurity professionals?
Dr. Graham, would you?
Yeah. Well, we have let me say one thing first. You know, like a lot of people became aware of NSU and cybersecurity this year with the $25 million grant.
Mm-hmm.
But we have been doing this since 2003. And we've been having many grants to develop the workforce since 2009. So this is a continuation of a long effort on our part.
Mm-hmm.
But we have several cybersecurity degree programs. We have a bachelor's in computer science with an emphasis in information assurance. We also have a master's in computer science degree with an emphasis in information assurance, which is basically cybersecurity. We are rolling out a new master's in cybersecurity this fall. Those are our main degree programs. We also target high school students through summer camps. We have several camps ongoing at the moment, and we use those for training. We send many students to internships every summer to work in cybersecurity defense environments where they can actually see the day-to-day attacks that are occurring. And those are our main efforts. We also have scholarships that we use to help develop our students. So, for example, Dr. Turn is in charge of cybersecurity competitions with the students to help them develop along those lines.
Yeah, and another thing is that cybersecurity has become quite interdisciplinary. So we collaborate with other departments, like in sociology and criminal justice, and also engineering. And so cybersecurity is linked to computing and computer science. So we're producing computer science graduates every year, and many of those are joining the cybersecurity field and the workforce. So those are some of the other things we're doing.
Well, I'm glad to see that we have been a forerunner in this effort to make sure that we have trained professionals to certainly be out there in the field and to be the gatekeepers, as it were. I saw a TV ad today, actually, for a cybersecurity program at UMUC, University of Maryland University College, and it was a young man on there, and he said, "I'm a hacker, but I'm one of the good guys." And I think that's kind of brilliant marketing, but I'm glad to see that Norfolk State has been doing this all along. This is the kind of thing that we've been doing, and perhaps a little known effort on the part of NSU to kind of go into the breach, if you will, and to shore up some of those areas where people can actually feel safe again. But again, in terms of the training for the new crop of cybersecurity professionals, what does the training actually entail?
I would say that one kind of training is students get hands-on practical labs like hacking, what we call ethical hacking. We have these virtual labs where they can learn how to break into machines, how to defend against attackers, how to do digital forensics, and find traces left behind by attackers. So students get a very good hands-on component in the cybersecurity classes, which imitate what is happening in real life.
Good. Now, some big names graced our campus back in January. Can you talk a little bit about that visit that was paid to NSU by Vice President Joe Biden, Governor Terry McAuliffe, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, and Senator Bobby Scott, and what that visit actually meant for the university?
Well, that visit was historic in several avenues. It was historic for our university because it was the announcement of a $25 million collaborative award.
Mm-hmm.
The vice president decided to come here to announce the award We were originally scheduled, and we did travel to the White House for the official announcement on Friday. However, the vice president was not going to be available. So he opted to visit our campus, and we said, sure. So it was historic in that this amount of money has never been awarded for cybersecurity previous to this announcement, and it has never been awarded to HBCUs with a prime, as a prime. So in those two respects, it was very historical for the country and for Norfolk State University.
Great. Any projections now on the number of cybersecurity professionals that will be needed in the future? It seems like this is an imperative. A lot of money is being infused into this area to make sure that we're on the front lines, that we're combating some of those challenges that are coming our way. What are the projections about the numbers of cybersecurity professionals that will be needed?
One report by Cisco suggested that there's going to be a shortage of between 500,000 and 1 million workers in the very near future. So, and the growth rate for jobs is around 37% for cybersecurity professionals. So there's a huge demand, and that's just an estimate.
Sure.
Within the last couple of years, the demand for cybersecurity professionals is growing, you know, at about 2 to 3 times faster than other information technology professionals. So if you have cybersecurity skills that you can add to your resume, then, you know, the likelihood that a job will be available for you is right.
Great. Now, let me just share this. I was also reading another article online the other day, and an interesting question was raised about corporations and even government introducing new protocols to ensure privacy and security. Now, if these protocols require people who have been compromised to submit new passwords and logins and to use data encryption, wouldn't they be just as vulnerable, if not more vulnerable, to cyber attacks since hackers know what and who to look for?
I mean, people are vulnerable. People tend to be vulnerable based on what they have to protect. You know, like if you use strong passwords and I mean, hackers basically already know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure they're going to be more vulnerable. But the people, the persons who are vulnerable are the ones who tend to have something that hackers really want.
Yeah, encryption is supposed to help. When you encrypt data, the data is scrambled. So unless you have the key and know the algorithm that the person is using, it's difficult to decrypt the data. Not impossible, but more difficult.
Okay.
Because those things actually should help. But, of course, there's nothing perfect. I mean, any system can be broken. But it's certainly better to take the protection measures than not to do it. You know, going back to an earlier question, we were talking about people who tend to inadvertently just click on links. But we can kind of look at how right now, when you go to the airport, we all have to go through security scanning. And it's the same kind of thing. We're going to have to sacrifice. Instead of just clicking on a link, we might have to go to a browser and actually type the URL in the browser because the URL that you click on may not correspond to the real URL. So those are some of the things. Some of it include sacrifice on users themselves.
Sure.
You know, in terms of being more careful.
Sure. Now, at some point, we're kind of looking at government intervention and making sure Americans are secure, but there's obviously a transparency issue, and people basically are a little afraid for one reason or another, and I'm not going to debate whether they should be or shouldn't be, but they're basically afraid that they don't know if they're going to get the true picture. In other words, how can people be assured that their privacy rights and their civil liberties are not being violated by cybersecurity programs? Because that's a huge issue.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they can ever be assured. I mean, the question is, how much confidence do you have in your government? If you come down to that. How much confidence do you have in those other people who are actually implementing programs?
Just as we've seen, like in the Snowden issue, there's always the insider threat. I mean, but when the agencies hire these people, they don't expect it. And then the other thing you have is that humans really are the weakest link in cybersecurity. For example, businesses can put all of the security and systems in place, but if humans don't use it properly, then it's insecure.
Mm.
So to answer your question, it's just that. How comfortable are you, as Dr. Graham said, you know, with confident in your American government?
Right. And I think this problem is not only a before cybersecurity, people used to question their government and in other ways, you know, they thought the government was spying on them. But I guess, like, it goes back to the same question, you know, how comfortable are you with the government? And there's just some things you'll never know. And you have to make decisions about what you think you need to do, what's more important for you as well.
Well, it's kind of the question, like, who's guarding the hen house? I mean, you want to make sure, number one, that government is looking after, you know, personal and private interests, but you also want to make sure that your information cannot be used against you, or that somehow you're being spied on, or that your information now is even more so compromised because more people know about your medical records, your medical history. If I'm trying to apply for a job at the CIA or with NASA or with Homeland Security, these things become real issues for me because maybe people will know more about me than I want them to know. So it is about, do I trust my government? And I certainly think that's a real question for a lot of people.
Yeah,
and I think it's also a legal issue. So I think that's something that legislation will have to pass to have better protection. But sorry, Dr. Graham, you were going to say something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would say people need to become as educated as possible. I mean, if it's your information, you need to find out, you know, who's protecting it and how they're protecting it, how safe it is. If you don't know those answers, then maybe you try to give as little information as possible that you don't have to. So what people need to become educated, and that way they can have at least a better idea as to what might be happening to the data. Because sometimes the information is there, but it's in fine print.
Well, you all have given us a lot of information, a lot of things to think about. I just want to go back a little bit to something we talked about earlier, and that's Norfolk State University being in the cybersecurity consortium. What will be some of its immediate goals, Norfolk State's immediate goals, as the lead institution in the cybersecurity consortium?
So as the lead institution, some of our immediate goals are to be able to assist some of the other partners that we have in the consortium by training the faculty on how to teach cybersecurity, providing them access to resources in which their students can get knowledge, you know, using our virtual lab. So as Dr. Graham mentioned earlier, we have virtual laboratories that are hosted online, like in the cloud. And so those students, even though they're further away, you know, in South Carolina, they can just log on to via web browser and then participate in those closed network environments. So we are sharing our resources to be able to give more people access to cybersecurity opportunities. So as the lead institution, we are just sharing our resources, providing access to our labs. We are partnering with faculty at those institutions for research opportunities, and we're providing support. You know, the whole goal of the consortium is to provide the opportunities, the information that relates to cybersecurity. You know, as long as Norfolk State has been in this business, we can't churn out all the students that are needed. You know, the number that was quoted earlier was 500,000 to a million. So as the lead for this consortium, we are about bringing everyone together, providing them with the tools and resources to be able to hopefully, you know, strike a dent in that number, you know, from the eastern area of the, you know, country.
I think that's an excellent initiative, and I also see that there's a public school district involved in this consortium. How does that work?
Yeah, like, actually, this summer, we are hosting two students and two staff members from that school district. They're here right to be at Norfolk State being trained in cybersecurity. The students are benefiting by being trained in cybersecurity. The instructors are learning how to take this information back to their school district and improve the curriculum in cybersecurity for the school district. So that's happening right today.
Do we know which school district that is?
It's the Charleston City, Charleston County School District.
Excellent. Okay, now it's time to land some home security. I hope you all noticed that I had a little play on words there. This is going to be our lightning round segment, so I want you to take turns answering the following 10 questions, and I'm going to start with Dr. Turner first. And just give us some quick answers, if you will, and just a little bit of elaboration, if you would do that for me. What's the best way to secure my Wi-Fi network? I'm at home. I'm a little concerned now because everything seems to get compromised very quickly. Dr. Turner, what's the best way to secure my Wi-Fi network?
Well, one of the first things you do when you first get your Wi-Fi, you want to make sure you change the default password, default username. So you might have to log into your router. There might be some instructions on how to do it. So you want to do that. That's a good way to do it. Usually the Wi-Fi uses the data is encrypted, so that's helpful. And basically using strong passwords again, when you do change the password, you know, make sure it's a strong password. I find it to be useful to use a password manager that generates the passwords for me. And, instead of you trying to worry about how will I build a strong password, it'll do it for you.
Oh. Is that better than you creating your own password, having one generated for you?
It's not better, but it's just as good. But the thing is, sometimes, you know, I guess if you have 100 passwords, and you have to sit down and make up 100 passwords.
Right.
It could be a feat, and sometimes you're so busy and on the go, and if you can have a software that is generated for you, that might be more practical for you depending on how many passwords you have.
And this is a follow-up question, Dr. Turner, because I have like 8,749 passwords, and it's difficult to remember all of them. What's the best way for someone at home on his PC to come up with different passwords for banking, for insurance, for whatever else he or she might be doing? What's the best way to come up with easy-to-remember passwords but difficult-to-hack passwords?
Right. Well, if you're going to make up a password manually, you can. One common way they mention is that you can pick a poem or some a page from your favorite book, and then you can try to come up with creative ways of creating a password from that. There's one simple way is just pick the first letter of every word, and then you can add special symbols, add numbers. You can play in that. Instead of picking the first correct, you can pick the last one or the middle one. It's up to you. That's one way. But if you have 700 passwords, that's a lot. So you're better off using a password manager, and you have a master. It's like having a safe where you keep other things. So you have one strong password for your password safe, and that has all your other passwords.
Right.
Now, that you want to keep offline, preferably, if that is sacrificed, then you lose all your passwords. So everything has risk involved.
Sure.
Right?
Well, so, I really need to simplify my life, so I think I'm going to
try this a different way. Quite a few password managers out there, and you have to just pick one. One that I use sometimes is called Password Safe, and I tend to use that sometimes.
Okay. Dr. Graham, do I need to secure my mobile devices, my tablet, my phone, and how do I do that?
Yes. I mean, there's software out there to do it. It all depends on what you do on your mobile devices. You know, these days there are more and more viruses on your mobile devices. So there's some virus checkers, some virus software available now. You don't want to connect to access points that you really not too sure about. And I would suggest that if you're doing some really private work, some important work, just connect to your wireless at home. If you're just browsing the internet, going to Google and so on, maybe you could connect to Norfolk State Wireless or other wireless that you trust. But the idea mainly is to connect to wireless access points that you trust. And keep being informed as the latest security breaches out there, the latest problems. One thing you may have to do is download some software updates, because typically once mobile devices have been hacked, the manufacturers provide some updated software to fix the problem. But I would say in general, try to stay on wireless access points that you really trust, and avoid doing, you know, just connect. You know, you go to the airport, you want to connect. You really have it everywhere we go. We want to be fully mobile. And
well, that's a great segue.
That's
a great segue for my next question for Dr. Williams. Paid virus protection versus free virus protection, is one better than the other?
That's an interesting question. Now, this truly is my personal opinion. I would say that paid virus protection is probably going to be better, but really what it's going to afford you is that if something happens, you have someone to call. That's what the paid virus protection is going to do for you. Free virus protection is it's open source, basically. So what that means is that persons are at their liberty to update it when they're going to update it. So, you know, if a virus is not made known, then the developers of the free software protection may not update it. Therefore, you may be vulnerable a little bit more or a little longer than you might be with a paid version. But there are definitely good uses for open source or free software, in that, you know, you have more of a community working to keep the product up to date, where paid software is licensed to a company and you're at their, you know, their schedule for them to release updates. But really what the paid software is going to get you is if something does happen, then you have someone that you can call that might provide you some service to recover your system in the event you were attacked by a virus.
Yeah, that sounds like just a common sense approach. I was actually going to ask you about your top recommendation for virus protection for home systems, but I don't want it to come across as an endorsement. So I'll talk to you when we're off the air and see what you can recommend, because I have some computer issues at home. Let me ask Dr. Turner, are mobile devices safer than PCs, and why?
Well, it goes back to the it's not a question. It goes back to what Dr. Graham was saying. It depends on what you connect your mobile, the access point that you connect your mobile device to. Because you could potentially connect your mobile device to someone else's access point who is trying to steal your information. So I think it comes with more risk, the mobile device. I mean, you have when the device is at home and it's connected to your network, and you have more control over your network.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to be going to different places and connecting to different access points, then there is more of a risk that something could happen. That's one of the problems, and I'm sure there are additional problems that could happen with wireless devices, but I can't think of any at this time. But that's probably one of the main ones.
That's okay.
You know, there are some devices out there where people kind of walk by close to your mobile device and steal the information as they pass. So your mobile device comes into contact with probably a lot more, as Dr. Turner said, a lot more foreign networks than your PC. Your PC is in your home, probably just attached to your provider. Your mobile, you know, comes into contact with lots of networks, authorized, some you don't even know about. Some hackers have some fancy devices that they can get your smart device to connect to it, and then all kinds of things happen.
Do we need to update our operating systems, and how often do we need to do that?
As often as possible. basically daily if you can.
but usually, you know, Microsoft has, you know, those automatic downloads that you can get the updates as needed. So you should allow your updates to be done frequently, because those updates, Microsoft finds lots of bugs in the software every day, and they have the patches available. They keep adding them on so you can download.
That's right.
So you should keep the things updated as much as possible.
Okay.
Yes, I agree that you update the operating system as much as possible, but also the software that's on your computer. You want to update those too as often as possible, because although your operating system might be very secure, if you're running very old software that are vulnerable, an attacker could come into your computer that way.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to, my next question is, how often should you look at your applications, and if they have an expiration date on your PC, do you need to do something to change that?
Yes, well, you know, the companies themselves provide updates for the various applications. Especially if you use something like Adobe, you notice almost every day Adobe is asking you to update.
Right.
So they provide updates. That's about it. That's what I would say about that.
Okay. How often should we change our passwords? I only have two more questions for you, so we're almost done with our lightning round. How often should we change our passwords?
I would say it depends on what you're protecting.
Mm.
You know, if you're protecting something very valuable, maybe change it at least once a month. If you're protecting almost nothing, you can take a couple of months, I guess. If you have state secrets you're protecting, who knows, maybe every week. I'm not sure. Maybe Dr. Williamson, she probably has more practical experience at this than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Most companies typically implement somewhere around the 90-day rule for you to change your system's password, and I think that's probably true here at Norfolk State University. But as Dr. Graham said, you know, it really depends on what you're protecting. And, you know, as we've shared earlier, the password could be the very one thing that compromises your system. So you want to make sure that you have fairly, you know, you have strong passwords, and that, you know, you might want to use passphrases. So that's what Dr. Turner was speaking of, is if you take a line from a poem and then you condense it by inserting uppercase, lowercase, special characters, numbers, you know, some way that you can read it, but it's condensed, then, you know, no one knows what it is. It's going to be much stronger that way. The flip side of that is remembering all of those passwords. But, you know, as mentioned earlier, you know, with mobile devices, sometimes you can have a PIN as a password. Other times you can have a finger code sliding, you know. You really want to modify those things sort of frequently. And then with your mobile devices, don't have all of your communication services open all the time. So like your Bluetooth, your Wi-Fi, if you're not using those things, then you want to turn them off, because if it's open, so for example, I'm probably guilty. My Wi-Fi, my Bluetooth is probably on because when I get in my car, it connects to my car. It's
right.
easy for me when
right.
I'm driving, right?
right?
However, if that's still on when I'm walking through the airport, for example, if someone has a Bluetooth scanner and they can connect to my phone, anything that I might have on my phone, passwords where maybe I've used apps to connect to my banking or whatever, they can retrieve the scanning from my phone. So you want to make sure that you only are using, you only have your communications open when you're actually using them. And that humans should get in the practice of turning those things off, changing your passwords, using passphrases, and just really being active in securing their resources.
Sure. This is just common sense approaches to how we can help to protect ourselves without necessarily relying on others in industry and corporations to do that for us. We just need to be a little bit more proactive and use a little bit of common sense about how we engage people when we turn on our devices and when we're on social media. I'm going to forego the last two questions, and I just want to thank all of you, Dr. Williams, Dr. Turner, Dr. Graham. We are nearing the end of this episode, but I just want to say thank you for joining us today. Cybersecurity is something everyone needs to understand, and certainly the threats which impact us both directly and indirectly are sometimes everyone needs to just be proactive in combating those. The more we use technology, the more all of us will need to safeguard our digital footprints, which is why we need watchers at the gate, so to speak. If our listeners are interested in learning more about cybersecurity, or if they're interested in this field of study, they can certainly log on to our website at www.nsu.edu, and we certainly have information there for them. If there is one brief takeaway, Dr. Williams, I'm going to ask you, if there's one brief takeaway that you would give to listeners today, what would that be about today's discussion?
Be involved in the security of your devices, resources that you access, and be mindful to implement some practices that's going to help you secure your personal identity and your sensitive information.
Great. Thank you so much again for joining us on this issue. Next up, we have your Spartan Life News Briefs. Be right back.
Good afternoon, everyone. These are your Spartan Life News Briefs. The 2015 AAU Junior Olympic Games are coming to NSU's Dick Price Stadium. The Hampton Roads Chamber of Commerce Sports Commission recently announced that NSU will be the host site for the 2015 Games, August 1st through 8. This event is the largest national multi-sport competition for youth in the U.S. About 15,000 youth athletes ages 7 through 17 from around the country will compete in 20 sporting events throughout the region. For more information or for a complete schedule of events, visit the AAU Junior Olympics website at aaujrogames.org. That website again is www.aaujrogames.org. Okay. Nearly 500 young people, including Girl Scouts, middle and high school students, and undergraduates, will take part in one of 8 summer science, technology, engineering, and mathematics STEM programs being offered at Norfolk State University. The programs began June 22nd and will run through July 17th, with a few starting in July. Students will get a chance to conduct independent research projects, participate in hands-on activities, strengthen their mathematics, science, and writing skills, and learn about the world of STEM. We are just about out of time, and so that's going to wrap up your Spartan Life News Briefs. I'm Sharon Hoggart with the Office of Communications and Marketing at Norfolk State University.
I want you to join us for our next episode of Spartan Life Radio Thursday, July 16th at 1 p.m. for a talk about transferring to Norfolk State. NSU's Transformation Center takes the hassle out of transferring from one school to Norfolk State University. Our guest will be Ms. Danielle Williams, Interim Director for Admissions. If you're thinking about continuing your education at NSU, you won't want to miss this episode. I just want to say that the author Stephen Vincent Benet once observed in 1937 that man progresses technologically but not ethically. That pre-atomic message is a sobering reality. I'm Michael Cotter, and you have been listening to Spartan Life Radio from the inside out. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Spartan Life Radio. Tune in bi-weekly on Thursday afternoons for another new episode of Spartan Life. For more information on Norfolk State University, visit nsu.edu or check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr.